Hi everyone, welcome to Take 30, All the Right Movies bi-weekly movie podcast. My name is Luke, and with me today are Matt.
Hello.
P.I. and John are here today, but they aren't here for the re-records, but you will hear their voices very soon.
Yes, you will.
On Take 30, we discuss our week in movies. That will then lead us into the main part of the show, which is this week's topic. We'll then round things off very nicely indeed with our Something New segment. And that's where we talk about something we've recently discovered in the movie world. Something for all you movie lovers out there. Mm-hmm. Good one today, isn't it, Matt?
It's a great one. It's one I'll still go back to.
Yeah, I haven't listened to it yet.
It's only been a year. No rush.
Any recommendations I get? Oh, yeah, I'll check that out. Definitely not.
On the shelf, gathering dust.
Okay, so our Take 30 show aired exclusively for our Patreon supporters over a year ago. The idea being that we would give it a limited general release after 12 months of being exclusive to our Patreon supporters. And this particular show was recorded in June 2020, so that'll account for a few of the sound issues that you'll be able to hear throughout. But we have upgraded our sound since, as you can tell by our deep, rich voices. Isn't that right, Matt?
Dulcet, some would say. Well, I've had private messages, I'll just put it that way.
Okay. Oh, lovely. Very nice. Yeah, been a long time coming, that as well, Matt.
It has.
You also may hear us talking about new movie releases. Releases that may not be so new now, but, you know, they were last summer. No. Still worth talking about, though.
Oh, definitely. If I could remember what they were. I'm sure they were good.
Professionalism.
Yeah.
Professionalism is, and that is what I want. So if you would like early access to our Patreon podcasts, you can sign up to be an ATRM Patreon supporter at patreon.com/allthe right movies. Any support that you can offer would be hugely appreciated, everyone.
It really would.
Keep us going. Keep us talking. Yeah. Loads of shit.
Yeah. You know, keep the heating on, wouldn't it?
Yeah, of course it would. I mean, it's getting winter.
It is.
So first up, the section that will always throw up a few surprises, that's our week in movies. And this is where we talk about films that we've been watching in the last week or so. So I'm coming to you first, Matt. What have you been watching?
Last night I had a rewatch of Stan and Ollie, which I enjoyed thoroughly just as much second time round.
I haven't really seen that before. Is it good?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, it's really good. The casting of Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly, absolutely spot on. You couldn't have found two more perfect actors for those roles.
Lovely.
Right? Really, really good.
It's in their less popular years, isn't it?
Yeah. There's like a very brief scene at the beginning that just sets the two of them up when they're kind of in the heyday and they're on top of the world. And then it skips out to the 50s. Actually, when it goes to the 50s, the first scene is in Newcastle.
Oh, really? So, you know, right? That's our hometown for all of our listeners.
Yes.
Oh, lovely. I think I'm going to watch it now then.
And then the other one this week, which I suspect a lot of people have done because it's new on Netflix, is Spike Lee's new joint, The Five Bloods.
Oh, I've watched it this week as well, and my God, it's amazing, isn't it?
It's great. Thoroughly enjoyed it. It's not, I wouldn't say it's a Vietnam film. I would say it's a Spike Lee film about Vietnam, and I think there's a difference. Frames that war, he looked at it in a different way. It's not about America losing its innocence like a lot of Vietnam films. It's angry. It's quite cynical. It's very political because it's Spike Lee, obviously.
Of course.
But it's really entertaining as well. And Delroy Lindo.
Oh.
Best performance I've seen this year.
It's incredible. I agree.
Just noises. Oh.
That's how good it is.
What about you, John? What have you been watching?
Well, I also watched The Five Bloods as well.
Oh, lovely. What's your take?
I pretty much echo what Matt just said. I thought it was very, very good. The story's excellent. It's well written. Some unexpected twists and turns. Along the way, Delroy Lindo is very good.
Fantastic.
Plays Paul, who's suffering from PTSD, and that starts to resurface once he's back in Vietnam. I wouldn't say it's perfect. I found the writing a little on the nose at times, and I found the music a little bit jarring as well. At times, it sounded a little bit like temp music.
Really? The Marvin Gaye stuff or the score?
The score, yeah.
Right, got you.
Marvin Gaye
stuff's amazing.
But overall, it's very good. Another very good Spike Lee film and well worth everyone's time, I think. I think Spike Lee's one of the most underrated directors, isn't he?
I think he's doing some of his best stuff now with this and Black Klansman a couple of years ago. Fantastic. Yeah. What about UPI? Any association football?
Not this week. So I watched something called I Love You Now Die, which is quite fitting, actually, because it's like a two-part documentary largely based in the courtroom. It's about this young woman who was on trial for the manslaughter of her boyfriend, who was accused of telling him to kill himself, like via this text message relationship that they had. I mean, if you like kind of a really serious but fairly emotive true story, which is quite well argued because you've got the two episodes that offer up the two sides of the story, then yeah, I'd recommend that. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I was right into it.
Lovely.
But I mean, you've got to be the type to really, you know, if you like something deadly serious, quite a touchy subject, then you know, watch it. If you don't, then don't bother. I watched Moneyball for the first time, which I enjoyed.
Fantastic.
I thought Pitt and Jonah Hill worked well together. So, you know, if you like your sport, which I talked about 2 weeks ago, and you haven't seen that one, then certainly give it a go. I also watched a film called The Wolf's Call, which was a French Submariner film. It's largely based around a young man who's an expert in sound detection. And it sounds really boring, but I found it really entertaining. I mean, there's some decent special effects and one or two decent action sequences. And then finally, I watched England Is Mine, which will be probably to very few people's tastes, but I really loved it. The film's about the backstory or the early life of one Stephen Patrick Morrissey, better known as Morrissey, the ex-lead singer of the Smiths. And they're one of my favourite ever bands, so I was really into this. Unless you're a fan of the Smiths, definitely don't bother with it.
Yeah, I've seen that one. It is pretty good. I enjoyed it, but I think I enjoyed it mainly because I like the Smiths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be the only reason to watch it.
If you go into it not knowing much about the Smiths or much about Morrissey, I think you'll find it probably quite hard to get into.
Yeah.
Absolutely, you will, yeah.
Morrissey, former lead singer of the Smiths, current cantankerous arsehole. I've been delving into the Kennedy family a little bit. I've watched a couple of films. Firstly, Jackie with Natalie Portman about Jackie Orr.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Follows the aftermath of JFK's assassination, kind of like the week after. And it's incredibly miserable. So,
it is.
Oh, God, yeah, it's so diabolically miserable. What a drag. And on the flip side, I watched JFK, Oliver Stone's JFK, all 3.5 hours of it.
Nice.
Love it.
That's what a film that is. Such an impressive feat of filmmaking.
Incredible.
So some nice recommendations there. Well, kind of touch and go. Peaks and troughs of recommendations there, I suppose.
More troughs than peaks, but...
Next on the agenda is something that you don't want to miss. Going way back to 1957, we're talking about Sidney Lumet and his debut feature, the Stonewall classic, 12 Angry Men.
Yes.
This week's topic.
So then, this week's topic is on the great man and great director that was Sidney Lumet. A native New Yorker, Lumet started his career as a child actor on stage and screen. As an adult, he made his way into directing Broadway shows and television for around 10 years. His debut film as director was the great 12 Angry Men. And in his 50-year career, he made a total of 44 films, with some highlights being things like Serpico, The Verdict, Network, loads more.
Yeah.
What do you think of Lumet as a filmmaker generally, Matt?
I'm a huge, huge, huge fan.
Yeah.
Like when I first started getting into film properly, he felt like a discovery because I already knew the names of people like Scorsese and Coppola. I knew what they'd done. Hadn't really heard of them. So when I first started watching his films and I started to piece them together, oh, the guy who did 12 Angry Men and he did Dog Day Afternoon as well.
Yeah.
And then when I looked at his career, I just thought, he's actually pretty exceptional. He's got a real variety of work in there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first got into him, he then went on for another 20 years or so.
I know.
He wouldn't give it up.
Always at a really good level of quality as well. So, huge fan. I think he's great.
Mm-hmm. John?
Yeah, I agree. I think he's brilliant. I think he's been a bit forgotten when you compare him to other directors with as many great films as him, which is a shame.
Really great.
But he has made some absolute classics. The Verdict, one of my favourites, where Paul Newman, who's one of my favourites as well, plays a sort of down-on-his-luck lawyer who has to pull it all together when he gets a last big case. That was the early 80s, but I think it's the 70s for me where Lumet really shone.
Yeah.
Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon are great. Murder on the Orient Express, I think, is really good.
Fantastic. Yeah.
But Network is my favourite. Yeah. Still feels really powerful and relevant today, and a fantastic cast. I think Faye Dunaway in particular in that is incredible. One of my favourite ever acting performances. She's superb. And obviously, Lumet was the person who worked with her to get that performance out.
Yeah.
I think when you look back now as well, at the 70s, I think Lumet is maybe second only to Coppola in the 70s when you look at the output of his films. Mm-hmm. And there were some great, great directors around in the 70s as well. So obviously a massive talent. And I think it's a little sad that he's not more well-known than he is.
It definitely is. Yeah. I heard somebody, a podcast I was listening to maybe about a month ago, and they were talking about Lumet, and one of them said he's probably got the best batting average of any director out there. Like on a consistent level. If you take a look at some of the films he's done, they just unfold and unfold. It's amazing the amount of great films he's done.
Yeah.
What about you, P.I.? You like Lumet?
Lumet or Lumet? Lumet?
Sid Lumet?
He's got to go into the bracket of one of the greats of the 20th century. I think, you know, he's got an extremely impressive, you know, body of important pieces of work. Some wonderful films under his belt. Pawnbroker, The Hill, with our friend Sean Connery, which is fantastic. Serpico, you know, which is so gritty and such a balmy take on kind of police corruption, which was a controversial subject to tackle at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Death Trap is great. I don't think he's.
I know you're a big fan of that one.
Yeah. I'm surprised John hasn't, because Christopher Reeve is superb in it.
I plan to watch it, yeah.
His films definitely speak for themselves.
So why is it then, do you think, that he's not as remembered as the other big names from the 70s? Household names like Coppola, Spielberg, Scorsese?
I think, for one thing, he never made, or his style wasn't like visually dynamic in the way that Spielberg, Coppola is. And probably when I look at all his amazing films, there's probably not one that quite broke through to the mainstream in the way that their other big films did.
Yeah, he hasn't got a Godfather on his hand. Yeah. Exactly.
Like you look at Dog Day Afternoon, it kind of had the misfortune of being nominated for Best Film in the same year as Jaws and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's bad luck, because any other year, Dog Day Afternoon's going to sweep the Oscars, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. It's an amazing film.
Yeah. And like, I always forget, 12 Angry Men is his debut.
Yeah.
I mean, what a film.
Yeah, what a debut.
Yeah.
I also think that his films have got much more appreciation over time, as opposed to getting the focus when they were released. I think it kind of there's been a lot more kind of reappraisal of his work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I think a lot of his films are for movie purists, really. They're not out-and-out kind of popcorn movies.
No.
So they're probably not as kind of accessible to a lot of movie fans.
Mm-hmm. Like Matt, he's absolutely one of my favourite directors. I absolutely love him.
Yeah,
like I said, there's 44 films in there and there's something for everyone. Obviously, we've talked about the big ones, but I really like The Morning After from 1986. It's got Jane Fonda and a young Jeff Bridges in. Very nice film. I don't know how old Bridges got before I stopped calling him a young Jeff Bridges. I think it must be Lebowski or something.
He's been around at least 15 years at that point.
Yeah. My favourite of Lumet is Prince of the City from 1981. What a film. That doesn't get talked about anywhere near enough as it should. It covers familiar ground with police corruption, but for me, I think it goes much deeper than Serpico, and it's got an amazing lead performance by Treat Williams, which is an unusual sentence to say, but...
It's a rarity, like, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
Collector's item.
And later films like Night Falls on Manhattan's great, and his sign-off film, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, with Finney and Hoffman. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's some cast, isn't it?
Yeah, amazing.
Very underrated, that one.
Yeah. So what we're going to do now is just focus a little more closely on one of his greatest cinematic achievements. We put a Twitter poll out to decide which is his best film out of 12 Angry Men, Serpico, Dog Day, and Network. And coming out on top with 42% of the votes was 12 Angry Men, his debut.
Guilty. 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 Not guilty. Guilty. Boy, how do you like that?
Oh, another chap flips his wings.
All right. Who was it? Come on, I want to know.
So, we're going to go 12 Angry Men in a bit more detail. So, firstly, John, are you guilty of loving 12 Angry Men?
You can apologize for that, to be honest.
Guilty. Not guilty.
There's probably only been two or three films that I've watched, and after just one viewing, thought, that's one of the best films I've ever seen.
Mm.
And 12 Angry Men is one of those films. It's magnificent. It is. I think Lumet does a great job, especially for being his debut. The cast, it feels like, are having an absolute whale of a time as well, which I love. But I think where it actually shines brightest is in the writing. The writing is just all-time great. We only learn like two characters' names, and that's in the final scene, but every character feels fleshed out and real. It explores all sorts of themes. The Trial of the Young Man's a story, but it works as an exploration of American society.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was written as a play, a teleplay, I think, originally, I think is pretty obvious, by a guy called Reginald Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And for all the great work by everybody else, and there is great work, for me, I think he's the star of the show. I think what's really telling about this film is that, like you say, Luke, we put this in the poll on Twitter up against other Lumet films, Tucky Afternoon, Serpico Network. This is the only one that's pre-Hollywood. It's the only one that's black and white, and it doesn't star Al Pacino. And it's still won by a long, long way.
Yeah, it did, yeah.
That's how good it is. I've never heard anyone say they don't like this film when they watched it. It's one of the best films I think I've ever seen.
What about you, PA? You like it?
Yeah, it's absolutely wonderful. Truly breathtaking, totally mirror what John says. In a way, it's a film that, certainly from my point of view, that promises or promised so little, and I expected an absolute snowfest. And yet, it's just so entertaining and so engaging from start to finish.
It is.
I mean, I first saw this in 1995. And
very
I know
specific.
That,
what was the date? Exact date?
I know it was 95 because as part of me English GCSE coursework, we were put into these groups to deliver like a play of sorts, I suppose, like a drama module. And one of the other lads in my group and I got together and we were chatting whilst I was at his house one weekend. And his dad overheard us and he said, why don't you watch 12 Angry Men? It's brilliant. So I did. And I was just amazed at how much I enjoyed it, to be honest. So I wrote this like 10 to 15 minute play based on the film. And we acted it out as part of the coursework in this group.
Oh, lovely. Were you Fonda?
I don't remember who played who, but one vivid memory I have is of pouring a glass of water from this jug that I'd placed in front of us on the table. And I took a huge nervous gulp and spilt half the glass of water down the front of my shirt.
Was that all part of the act?
No, it was just I was just nervous to be like acting in front of the rest of the class and the teachers build it all down my top, so that was unfortunate, but got a bit of a chuckle. but yeah, I mean, I've loved this since 1995, specifically.
So what was your play called then, PI?
Two Angry Men.
Five Angry Men.
Five Angry Men.
Lovely. I would love to see that recreated one day, maybe for our Patreon subscribers.
Have you still got the script?
No, but I mean, I'm sure I could come up with something which was pretty similar, considering I haven't gained any intelligence since I was 15.
Lovely. What about you, Matt? Where do you stand on 12 Angry Men?
Oh, man. Well, I'm not going to vote against everyone here, put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just brilliant in every way, shape, or form. And as John says, you can show it to anyone and they'll be entertained by it. What always impresses me is how many hurdles Lumet's got to overcome to make it work. It's only 90 minutes long.
Yeah.
95% of it is set in one room.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to introduce 12 characters, get you to know each and every one of them, where they're coming from in regards to this decision. And then he's got to make 11 of them change their minds and make it all
and make
possible.
It believable. Yeah.
Make it believable in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And he just pulls it off and you don't even think twice about it. You know, the acting's phenomenal. how he makes it cinematic, because it could have been really, really stagey, could have been quite a dull thing to watch, and you would have just concentrated on the acting and the writing. But you don't even, from a visual sense, it's an exciting film. Yeah, it's just, anyone who wants to make films should watch it, because it teaches you so much.
I would insist, I mean, if I had any pull, and I definitely don't, but once we get big and we do have a bit of pull, I'm going to insist that for every member who ever becomes part of a jury, they have to watch this before the start of the debate.
We're going to need a hell of a lot of pull. You start pulling the strings in the British judicial system.
Give it a month.
Well, I've got to be honest with you here, fellas. Until last week, I had not seen 12 Angry Men.
Really? Houses.
Mm-hmm.
Blimey.
Yeah.
Snob. We get snobby about it being a black and white.
I don't know. It's always been on my list to watch, but I just never got round to it. And I think somewhere subconsciously, it's because it's pre-70s and because it's black and white. And I just think, oh, it might be a bit stuffy. The actor might be a little bit wooden. But I've been missing out all these years because I absolutely loved it. Fantastic. I love that it's one location, and I love that it's in the real-time story as well. And there, like we've talked about, there are 12 fantastic performances. Mm-hmm. What I like is that we never see any action. We never see any of the crime in question. The film does this amazing job of painting the picture of the scene in your mind's eye. And I think that the way it unravels, I sway from one conclusion to the next. And one minute I'm thinking guilty, the next I'm thinking not guilty. And it's back and forward and back and forward. And I think that that's absolutely amazing that the story unravels like that, as one key detail gets revealed and then knocked back, and then another one gets revealed and then counted again. Mm-hmm. Fantastic stuff.
Wonderful, yeah.
It's got 100% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes, one of the few films, and it's 8.9 out of 10 on IMDb, which places it fifth in their greatest films of all time list.
Wow.
Whoa, holy moly.
Very big.
I'm really chuffed with that. I'm over the moon. Yeah. Because I adore this. I didn't think it would be rated that high. Yeah. That's wonderful news.
Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a massive film here, a really, really important film. Like you said, it was a TV movie, John, in the early or the mid-50s, but 12 Angry Men was remade in 1997 as a TV movie directed by William Friedkin. Anybody seen that?
I haven't seen that one. I know it's got Jack Lemmon in the lead. I know it's directed by Friedkin. I really quite fancy it.
I have watched it, obviously, in preparation for this. It's not as if I'd seen that one and not seen the original.
You watched the wrong one. What is this? This big reputation.
That's got Jack Lemmon in, like, who's wonderful.
The cast is absolutely incredible. Edward James Olmos is in there. James Gandolfini. William Peterson. A favourite of yours, P.I. Tony Danza's in there.
Hold me close now.
But yeah, you're right. Jack Lemmon plays the fonder part, and George C. Scott, full of bombast, over the top, overacting, plays the Lee J. Cobb part.
What he does.
Right.
And strangely, C. Scott took over the J. Cobb part in The Exorcist 3, which is incredible.
That's right. Two peas in a pod.
Obviously, the original, directed by Billy Friedkin, the original Exorcist as well. Loads of massive coincidences.
Two peas in a cob.
The 1997 one is fantastic.
Is it?
Yeah, really good.
All right, I'm going to watch it then.
It fleshes out the characters a little bit. I mean, I would say for about 70% of the film, you're thinking, I have no idea why this has been remade, because it's just basically the same.
Right.
It's exactly the same, in fact.
What, line for line?
Line for line. The teleplay was done by the same person who wrote the original teleplay and who adapted it for Lumet as well.
Right.
So it's pretty much the same thing, but the characters do seem to be fleshed out a little bit more. It's brought up to more modern-day kind of stand-ins. Four of the jurors are black. The judge is female, but, I mean, pretty much everything else apart from that, it's pretty much identical. But it's still, I mean, it's a great film because it's a great story and it's amazingly written. But still worth watching, definitely.
Yeah, check it out.
Mm-hmm. It's in the lineage of great courtroom dramas, this one. Where does it stand amongst the best for you, John?
It's a slightly strange genre to me, the courtroom drama. Usually they follow the same sort of structure where the films are built up over about 90 minutes around the lawyers investigating the case and then climax in a final act where it's all massively dialogue heavy set in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's done well, it can be fantastic. But I don't think for me there's a huge amount of great examples of courtroom films. Mm-hmm. I like A Few Good Men a lot. That's got absolute fireworks in the final act between Cruise and Nicholson. To Kill a Mockingbird is also absolutely fantastic. The courtroom scenes there are more relaxed, still completely gripping. But I do think 12 Angry Men is number one.
Really? Mm-hmm. Number one? Wow.
For me, yeah. Flips the typical structure on its head by having everything take place basically in one room. We don't see hardly anything that takes place in the courtroom, which is an interesting way of doing it.
Yeah.
And from the very first seconds of the film, I'm always totally engaged. As soon as they start talking about the facts of the case, I'm hooked immediately every time I watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's the best courtroom drama for
me. That's pretty great. What about you, Matt?
It's just hard to see how anything can top 12 Angry Men now, because it just set the standard, and it's almost weird to call it a courtroom drama. You don't actually see the lawyers, any of their arguments, which you tend to see in a lot of others. When it's done well, it can be really good. Like when JFK gets to that moment, that's really brilliant. The courtroom section of that film. I am a big fan. We mentioned it with Schumacher, A Time to Kill. I think that's really good. That's really, really good. Gripping. But yeah, it's still got to be 12 Angry Men, because it just sets the standard for that kind of drama, which is, because what I like about it is it's always about the kind of moral and ethical and intellectual argument rather than something kind of visual.
Yeah.
So if the script nails that, if it gets a real good proper argument that makes you think, it can be as gripping as anything. And I think just 12 Angry Men grips you like nothing that's come since.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. What about you, PI? Have you got anything that will beat 12 Angry Men?
No, I think I pretty much just want to echo what both the guys have just said and say, for me, I think it's, you know, it's the original and it's the best. And like they both said, it's not really a courtroom drama per se, because it's more a jury room drama, of which I haven't seen another one of. So it's like, you know, it definitely stands on its own in that respect. I mean, I do like a courtroom drama, to be honest, if you want to kind of put it into that phrasing. The ones that spring to mind have already been said. So Philadelphia is great. There's an extended courtroom scene in that.
Heartbreaker.
The Verdict, the end of that, which is obviously another Lumet film. That's got a great courtroom scene in. There's not one of them focuses so intently on the jury and all being in the same room. The ability to kind of keep the content exciting and engaging is what I think makes 12 Angry Men the most impressive out of any of them.
Very nice. Very comprehensive rundown there as well, P.I.
I was hoping for a Jack Nicholson impression at some point there, P.I., but we didn't seem to get one.
No. Can we have one?
You wouldn't be able to handle it.
Oh, lovely. Understated. I couldn't agree more with all of you there. I didn't notice Anatomy of a Murder thrown out there by any of you, which I do love.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Terrible Omission.
And I'm going to throw a curveball in there as well. I like My Cousin Vinny.
Great, hilarious.
I love that film. Yeah, just didn't feel very funny. That's brilliant.
You've never seen it, John? Oh,
it's
should check it out.
Worth watching. Brilliant.
Loads of fun.
So funny.
It is loads of fun.
Marissa Tomei in that.
Tomei got an Oscar for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very nice. And Pesci's having so much fun.
Oh, he's brilliant.
You can even get past the fact that Ralph Macchio's in it.
Yeah, but he's not in too much. Yeah.
Pesci's always having fun.
Yeah, he is. I think this is after Goodfellas, where he just got the confidence from that Oscar win and he's just being all crazy Pesci. As I said, this was Lumet's directorial debut. It was based on the 1954 live broadcast TV show from CBS, written by Reginald Rose. The success of that led to a film adaptation produced by Henry Fonda. He recruited Reggie Rose to adapt his story for the screen, and Rose suggested Lumet for director as they'd worked together on TV. Fonda had seen Lumet's Broadway show, which was good enough for him to hire him on the spot. So, what do you think of Lumet's work specifically on this film, P.I.?
Well, given that it's, you know, his breakout film, his debut, I think, you know, there's an immediately obvious sign of talent and confidence and belief that you rarely see in directors apart from the ones right at the top of that elite pile. I mean, like I said, this was his first feature, so how he manages to capture the imagination in that one room for the entirety of the film is incredible. I love his understanding of where he's putting the camera. I love how much it is like a play that John mentioned, I mean, I think the first shot, the film, when they first get into that room, it's like four or five minute continuous shot. And the camera kind of moves in and out. You've got a range of like long and mid shots throughout. It's spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And I love, in particular, the way that he uses the angles to kind of show that gradual elevation of power that Henry Fonda kind of absorbs almost.
Mm.
Now he's quite small in a lot of mid shots at the start. And the camera's normally kind of luring above him. You know, we get to see that he's got this pressure on his shoulders. He's this lone voice. But then as he starts to kind of win over the other jurors, we see him towering above the camera. There's more close-ups. He's in the frame with your other characters because he's their equal, or he's kind of, you know, superseding them.
Very nice. Matt?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we talked about Spielberg last week, because obviously they've both come from the TV background mm-hmm. before coming in the film. And I think you can tell, especially with Lumet, because working in TV, you just don't have much time. You've got to get it right, and you've got to get it right quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell that with this. It's very snappy. It's very confident. He knows exactly kind of what PI was saying there. He knows exactly where to put the camera. And I think it just plays to his strengths. And I think his strengths are dealing with actors. I think he's a great actor's director.
Yes.
And he's also really comfortable with dialogue. He's really comfortable with characters just talking at each other and getting the drama just out of the dialogue, mm-hmm. which is obviously what 12 Angry Men is. He knows when to go in for a dramatic shot, like when Fonda picks out the second knife that he bought at the
moment,
and he just slams it into the table.
Yeah,
and
great.
The camera's like, boom, straight in there.
Yeah.
He stands up, doesn't he?
Yeah, he stands up.
He knows in the camera, and then he slams the knife down. Yeah it's great.
Yeah, it's brilliant. He just knows what he's doing so well with this.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely playing his strengths throughout.
I agree. What about you, John? Lumet on this?
Brilliant. I'm not going to see him as rubbish, am I?
Thank God. The eye will have a fit.
I think it's impressive how cinematic he manages to make it, where he's basically just shooting 12 guys sitting around the table for 90 minutes, essentially. Yeah. The camera work is really, really good. I love all the extreme close-ups, which are quite, I think intentionally, quite jarring.
Mm-hmm.
Loads of slow zooms into people when he wants you to put emphasis on what people are saying. That's all really good. The way the camera moves around the table is really good. There's two things in particular that he did, which I think are fantastic.
Okay.
So at the beginning of the film, the cameras are usually above eye level. So it's always looking down slightly mm-hmm. on all the jurors. Mm-hmm. And he used wide-angle lenses as well, Lumet, to make it seem like there was a bit of distance between each of the 12 jurors. As the film goes on, the cameras move down to eye level, and then by the end, it's nearly all shot below eye level,
mm-hmm.
which makes the room seem like it's getting smaller and smaller and more claustrophobic as the story unfolds and becomes more tense.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's all over and we leave the courthouse, for really the first time, we see a long, wide shot, which makes it feel like all this tension suddenly being released.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I agree.
And also, before shooting as well, Lumet had all the actors stay in the same room for like days rehearsing without filming anything because he wanted to give them all a real taste of what it would be like to be stuck in the same room with the same 11 guys for hours and hours on end.
Yeah. I think you can see that in the performance. I don't think you'd have the film that you've got if it wasn't for that kind of preparation.
Mm-hmm. Probably not, no. I think the fact that you can actually talk about the direction of a film like this shows how good a job that he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it could easily just be a bit nothing. And he could have just relied on the script and the cast if he wanted, because he's already got a fantastic script and a fantastic cast.
Yeah.
And he probably didn't have to do a great deal to make a good film. But by doing what he does, he makes an all-time classic.
I agree.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think what he does amazingly well is creates this, kind of what you were saying, John, about those close-ups that gradually build in and build in. He creates this incredibly claustrophobic atmosphere. I think it's helped by the tension of the discontent between the jurors kind of squaring off against each other. But because it's set in one room and you can almost feel that heat in there as the film goes on.
Mm.
And that's obviously highlighted by the sweat marks that are on everybody. Sweating like pigs.
Really sweaty.
You can smell it, can't you? You smell the sweat and the steel smoke.
Yeah.
Like John mentioned that last shot, it's like you get a big breath of fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it? When you see Fonda outside, you're like,
Thank God for that.
Thank God for that, I'm outside.
Yeah.
Everyone apart from Fonda and the one juror who's the spectacles guy.
The eyeglasses.
Yeah, the eyeglasses guy. the way that they use it, when you see that one bead of sweat dripping off his head as he's been interrogated, that was has so much impact, because before then he said, I don't sweat.
Yeah, it's already been set up.
So you get a massive impact of him breaking out into sweat under this pressure.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, like you said there, Luc Fonda was a producer on the film,
mm-hmm.
and he was instrumental in getting Lumet in. I know that Lumet was nervous about impressing Fonda as well, because Fonda was a massive, huge movie star at the time.
Mm-hmm.
When they came to do a test screening, all the cast and crew were there, and in the middle of it, Fonda got up and walked out, and Lumet was like shitting himself, thinking, shit, he hates it.
Mm-hmm.
Then Fonda grabbed him afterwards when he came out and said, I just don't like watching myself on screen, but Sydney, it's magnificent.
Oh, lovely, very Russ. Nice.
Yeah, lovely. Well done, Sydney. About that closer camera work, it gets closer and closer to the camera's faces. Lumet said that I seek out confined areas to work in. I wouldn't know what to do with a Western. I wouldn't know where to begin with those big, wide open spaces. Mm. And that fits perfectly with this film, just this one location.
Yeah, well, if he loves the confined space, he's the perfect guy for this film.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, we put this out on Twitter, and there were some comments about 12 Angry Men as well. A comment from P. Katarina on Twitter. They said that the film makes you truly appreciate great actors who excel at their craft. And they also called it casting perfection. With that in mind, John, who's your favourite character in this film?
Well, I think we should probably start with the main man, the lead character.
Yeah, why not?
Henry Fonda.
White suit.
Juror number 8.
Mm-hmm.
Davis, as we find out later, he's called.
Yep.
Davis, that's it.
Obviously, he was the biggest star in the film by some distance, and I think he's fantastic. Plays the most reasonable man in the room.
Yeah.
The film is an ensemble cast, but it does sit on Fonda's shoulders more often than anybody else's.
It definitely does, yeah.
And he carries it effortlessly. Yeah. I think it's a great performance.
Certainly the first half, doesn't he? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I do like his full white suit as well. Stands out.
Yeah.
I suppose it's symbolic of how he's like the kid's guardian angel, almost.
Lovely.
Something
lovely. Very lovely. Nice.
The only person looking out for him at the start of the film. I know as well that because the film had such a small budget, I think it was $330,000.
Yes, it was.
Fonda agreed to defer his salary. So him making money was dependent on the film making money.
Mm.
The film flopped at the box office. So Fonda didn't actually get paid for 12 Angry Men.
Wow.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
Wow. It is.
And Reginald Rose, the writer, had the same deal. He deferred his salary as well, so he didn't get paid anything either.
Lovely. Well, not for him, but, you know, wonderful man.
Lovely fact.
I love that Henry Fonda's character doesn't take this as kind of like a personal crusade that he's trying to get everybody on his side. He doesn't actually know if the kid's guilty or not guilty, but he just wants to talk about things. And when people do flip from guilty to not guilty, he's not like thinking it's a personal victory.
He just wants to make sure the kid gets a fair trial, exactly. Which at the start he clearly isn't getting.
No, not at all.
Or made the minds up based on nothing.
Yeah.
Without really thinking things through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not an ego trip for him, is it?
Not at all.
He's not throwing out the high fives when he changes people's mind. I like how he's almost kind of reluctant to speak up at the beginning, but he feels he's got to.
Yeah. He is. Yeah, well, you would be because it's a threatening environment. You've got 11 dudes. Yeah.
Well, I think it was always going to boil down to that scenario because, as we learned later, he went out the night before and got the knife. So I think it was already on his mind that he thought there was something more to the story than just a straight out, you know, open and shut case that he was guilty.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he has to kind of go into it knowing that he's a lone ranger almost when he finds out it's 11v1. But the initial intention was for him to say, I don't think he's guilty. I think we should talk about it because the bits that just don't add up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what strikes me is if there'd been 11 votes for not guilty, he would have probably voted guilty.
Just to talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Loves a chat.
Lonely man just wants some friends.
What about you, Matt? Who's your favourite character in the film?
I'm going for juror number 7, Jack Warden. He pretty much steals the film for me, and it's a tough film to steal, but I think he just about does it. I love the fact he's kind of the everyman, because I think most people would probably just want to get out of there as soon as possible and would vote whatever way it gets him out the quickest, because obviously he's got this baseball match to go to.
Yeah.
So, which in a way, it's kind of disturbing that someone would vote that
really
way.
Really disturbing.
Yeah. It's like, just, look, whatever gets me out of here the quickest, I'll go with you. Even when he changes his mind, I think he's just doing it for an easy.
He's sick of all the talking, doesn't he?
Yeah. Think this is the way it's going, so I'll just hurry it along. So I like that about him. But he's also the one bit of comic relief in the film. I think he's hilarious. I love it when he's screwing up the paper and the balls and throwing it behind him off the fan.
Yeah.
And then the one bounces off the old fella's face.
That's a damn stupid thing to do.
That really makes me laugh. Fonda as well. He's kind of pacing around the room to demonstrate how long it would have taken the witness to get out of bed. And Warden starts whistling the Laurel and Hardy theme tune as he's taking the piss. I think that's hilarious as well. Yeah.
I think he does a James Cagney impression as well at that point as well, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
Does he?
Yeah. Okay, killer, okay.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
That's right, he does, yeah. Yeah, he's just a great character. He always makes me laugh. I think he gets most of the best lines, and I just hope he made the baseball game in the end.
Surely it was rained off.
He was definitely my favourite character when I was a kid. When I watched it at 15, he was my favourite.
He's way out of his depth. I don't think he contributes a single meaningful point to the entire conversation.
No, he doesn't.
No, he doesn't. No.
Sid's looking out the window. I know as well that he looks at his watch a total of 28 times during the film.
Come on.
Desperately the Yanks versus Cleveland.
Yeah. I like how he's like annoyed at the other guy when he's trying to talk about baseball. He finds out he supports Baltimore. He's just like, Baltimore?
Yeah.
Calls him Baltimore from then on as well.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
I think it's testament to the writing as well that there's so much set up and payoff in the whole film. Like when you watch Jura 7 all the way through, you want them to get, because from the very first seconds he's saying, let's get out of here as soon as possible, eh? And you want someone to have a go at him. And
then
the European guy does.
Yeah.
So it's been built up all that time. Uh-huh. And when he does, and he starts just stuttering like, oh, I just think he's guilty.
I just think he's guilty.
What about you, P.I.? Who's your favourite character?
I'm going to go for Jura number 9, or as we learn at the end, McArdle. My name's McArdle.
Oh, the little old fella.
The sweet old fella. Henry Fonda's ancient sidekick.
He busts the case wide open, doesn't he, with the eyeglasses story?
He absolutely does, played by Joseph Sweeney. I think, you know, we were talking about Keaton getting in there as Batman again. I'd love to see this old boy in there as Robin. I mean,
surely he's not with us any longer. Surely.
He died in 1963, like, but, you know, modern CGI, you know, that would take care of that minor issue. He's pretty much the Jura who's kind of most relatable to the audience. I think he's supposed to represent us. He's polite, he's respectful, he waits for his chance to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I like when they have that initial vote where you think that everyone's going to vote guilty and he's the one that kind of steps up to the plate and starts the ball rolling with the guts of the discussion. So I love that about him, that he has the guts to back up Fonda at that moment. I like a lot of his lines, you know, they come from a kind of really mature, measured experience standpoint, so we understand that with kind of age and experience comes wisdom, and that should kind of garner respect almost, I suppose. My favorite line is when that racist fella's wiping his nose.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about, you know, the kind of person that he believed the defendant to be, and he says they're born liars. And the old fella says, only an ignorant man would say that. Do you think you were born with a monopoly on the truth? Absolutely love that line.
Yeah,
you know, it's one I've loved it since I heard it at age 15. I think it's kind of just such a quick retort, but it sums up such a lot.
Did you sneak line into Five Angry Men?
I think that was me.
I wrote that.
Not a mind that.
I loved it. I think I did. I did write the monopoly on the truth into the little 10 to 15 minute play that I wrote. Yeah. He saves the day at the end.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who brings up the lovely dialogue about the eyeglasses.
Mm-hmm.
First, we think it's going nowhere. I mean, you're almost kind of like saying, oh, what a
silly
sweet
old man.
A
bit, yeah.
The rest of the jurors are kind of, you know, he turns out to be the case cracker. this final sway that, gets everyone to believe that there's reasonable doubt.
He is great. I think Joseph Sweeney is fantastic in the film. Really, really good performance. And I think the character is great as well. I like the role that he plays in the film, how the theme of ageism sort of revolves around him.
Yeah.
I think the saddest part of the film is the bit when he's saying, like you mentioned there, P.I., he's talking about the old fella who was the witness and says he's probably lonely and convinced himself that what he's saying was true.
Mm-hmm.
And the other shouting down. And Ed Begley, who plays the bigoted juror, is like, what do you know about it? And he just puts his head down and starts shaking his head. That bit's really sad.
Yeah.
But then I love it when he gets his moment, when he does identify the eyeglasses. I love that little moment where Fonda's like, there's 11 people here and none of us realised either. And he touches him on the arm.
Yeah.
He does. Oh, yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Little moment.
Very nice. Great. Well, I suppose there's only one place left for me to go, and that would be juror number 3, played by Lee Jacob.
Of course.
Yeah. The one we've all been waiting for.
Angriest of all the men.
He is from the get-go.
He is, yeah.
It's his kid.
I really do love Cobb. Absolutely love him on account of things like On the Waterfront and The Exorcist, obviously. And he's fantastic in this. I mean, he's not the most likable of chaps, but I think out of all the cast, I think he's the one who's got probably the most fleshed out character.
Possibly, yeah.
He's got this kind of like emotional...
A little bit of his backstory.
You do, absolutely, yeah. There's some real emotional depth there on account of his broken relationship with his son, which fuels his anger and basically his rage throughout is directed not at the defendant, but at his son and his relationship with his son.
Yeah.
I love that moment where he absolutely snaps, where Henry Fonda calls him, says he's the executioner, high executioner or something like that. Yeah. And this is a kind of a favourite theme of Lou Metz, that family dynamic and usually a broken relationship between a man and his son. He said that the family relationship is the perennial source of drama in films. And he taps into that all the time and no better than in this. I think this character, although he's difficult to relate to, completely breaks down at the end, and that's really affecting. That's a really dramatic moment and really perfectly acted by Cobb.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lovely touching moment at the end where Fonda offers him his suit jacket.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice.
Put on without saying anything. It's like kind of the war was over.
Truce.
Yeah. I think he's fantastic. Yeah, we've talked about him before in The Exorcist. You guys talked about him rightly because he's great in that. I think his best performance might be in On the Waterfront. This is the film that I always think of when I think of Lee J. Cobb, probably because this was the first place I ever saw him and I've always liked him. I mean, how angry is he?
So
all the way he's a volcano ready to erupt constantly. He's like opposite of Fonda, where Fonda's really reasonable and pragmatic. Cobb is just anything but. I love the exchanges between Cobb and Fonda, and this happens 2 or 3 times, where Fonda will be saying something like, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm saying the witness could be mistaken. Is that not possible? And Cobb's like, no. And Fonda will say something like, it's not possible? No, it's not possible. How many times does Cobb say, no, it's not possible, about things that are definitely possible? It could be mistaken. No, I'm saying it's not possible. Constantly ranting and raving. And at the end, when he goes on his massive rant, and he's just pointing with both fingers at everybody, completely loses the plot.
Looks amazing with those big hefty points.
How he torpedoes his own argument completely when he's gone on about the old man.
How could he be sure of anything?
Shit.
We see him, he immediately realizes that he's dug his own hole.
Yeah.
He's great.
Yeah. A number of themes going on in the film. We've touched on a few of them. Do you think they're still relevant today?
Absolutely. Without doubt. As I said before, I think the writing is absolutely superb and it's got themes coming out of its ass.
Oh, really? It has.
Race, class, family, masculinity, ageism, others on top of that are all explored in detail. I think different characters often represent a different theme and there's often an overlap between them as well. Juror number 10, who is Ed Begley, who we mentioned, covers race and masculinity. Cobb covers off family and masculinity.
Yeah.
It's all done fantastically well. They've basically all been given the same information in the court, but because of their personalities their life experience and their outlook on the world, they all interpret those facts completely differently to each other.
In different ways, it's really, really
clever. Something I noted quite strongly when I watched this just a few days ago before doing this is actually the relevance to social media nowadays.
Okay.
Obviously, this was made decades before the internet, never mind social media, but it reminded me of Twitter so strongly. Nowadays, if a young black man's murdered in America by a policeman, it blows up on Twitter. And the conversations the jurors have in this film are the exact sort of conversations you see happening on Twitter today.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
It feels like a microcosm of social media in particular, which I think it shows how precise the writing is. And I think it shows how it really gets to the core of how society was then and still is now. And I think that's probably the main reason why it's still so popular. A 15-year-old could watch this now and totally understand it and recognize all those characters back to front.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite
a great point.
Yeah.
I think that's probably why it's endured so long.
What's crazy is that there are assumptions made about this character based solely on his upbringing and his background. And that's still happening all over the world right now. There are people out in the streets protesting for change for minority groups to give equality. And it's unbelievable that we're still talking about this 63 years on. It's absolutely insane that it's still massively relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just feel like I'm going to repeat what John said, really. I mean, it's actually quite sad that it's still so relevant.
Oh, God.
Because the idea that you would get 12 people to decide someone's fate and those 12 people wouldn't bring any prejudice to their decision whatsoever, whether it be about race, ethnicity, age, class, gender, I think that's a bit of a fiction, really. And it's sad that it is still so relevant today.
Absolutely. P.I.?
Yeah, I mean, well, it goes without saying that it's, you know, completely relevant given what's going on around the globe and especially in America right now. So, you know, it's obvious that it's relevant. You know, it always will be. You know, there'll always be controversy, unfortunately. There'll always be discrimination and outsiders and marginalised people. There'll always be wrongdoing. You know, whenever we see a film that gives a well-thought-out commentary on some form of controversy or injustice, will doubtless see the influence of this film, in my opinion.
Yeah. I also think there are themes in there that Lumet covers a lot throughout a lot of his films, and those are things like questioning of authority, and probably most specific is like morality. There's a big theme of that running through a lot of his films. On that, Lumet said, "I'm not directing the moral message. I'm directing that piece and those people in it. And if I do that well, the moral message will come through."
Yes.
Nice.
Sadly, Sidney Lumet died on the 9th of April 2011, aged 86. We've talked about it a little bit, but how do you think he's viewed in Hollywood today? What do you think his legacy is?
Any director who tries to make like a serious-minded drama that grapples with some kind of moral or ethical dilemma, I think they're just a huge debt to how Lumet did it. Because that's such a prevalent theme in his films, you know, a big dilemma to grapple with at like an adult level. And whenever you see a film about some kind of whistleblower, generally think, oh, you know, that was pretty good, but it's not Serpico, is it?
Or
if you watch a film about a bank heist or a robbery or some kind of criminal endeavor that goes really badly wrong or there's some kind of media circus around it, you're like, well, yeah, wish I was watching Dog Day Afternoon, though.
Yeah.
Because often I think when other directors try to do these type of topics, it can be quite heavy-handed. But I think Sidney Lumet has a really light touch. They deal with serious topics, but they're always really entertaining as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think at the heart of them, they're all about the character as well. If it's a bank heist, it's just about the characters, though. The bank heist just superfluous.
It's almost like the kind of window.
Secondary almost.
Secondary, yeah. It's more about what the characters are going through. And,
exactly.
And I think that's like an underrated skill to get to the heart of that. So that's what I think his legacy is, to show how you can do dramas like that.
What about you, P.I.?
I think his legacy is bravery, I think, kind of being able to have the guts and the confidence to tell a story with a way that we need to hear it, you know, balls to the wall almost. It's like
lovely.
There's very little sugarcoating, I think, with his work. And I think that's why it's, you know, it's so important. He speaks to any filmmakers out there and saying, kind of show the film as you see it in your head, you know, tackle the issues that are difficult or cause controversy, because there's potential there to tell a real timeless, important piece of cinema.
Wonderful. What about you, John?
In terms of how Sidney Lumet viewed the day, I think we covered it at the top.
Yeah.
He's been mostly not forgotten, but underappreciated, I think is probably the right word, which is a shame when you compare him to other directors who've got the amount of quality films he has. They're all much more well-known. But in terms of his legacy, I think you can definitely see him in other classics since. A Few Good Men, we mentioned, was written by Aaron Sorkin and has that same whip-smart, snappy dialogue where there's no wasted words that we see in 12 Angry Men. I think David Mamet took massive inspiration from 12 Angry Men when he wrote Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's about real estate salesmen, but themes of masculinity running through that, even more so than in 12 Angry Men, and it's all set largely in one location as well.
Yeah.
I think what I'd like to see people taking from him is taking the approach that Lumet takes to Dog Day Afternoon. I think nowadays, or anytime, if a lot of directors did Dog Day Afternoon, they'd focus on the action, whereas Lumet doesn't give a shit about that. He gives a shit about the characters. Absolutely. That's all he cares about. He cares about the two brothers and what they are going through.
Yeah.
Another film where one of the characters gets really, really sweaty. Pacino is sweaty as fuck.
Drenched.
Like Robert Hayes in Airplane.
Lovely.
He is a great director for me. I wouldn't call him one of my favourite directors, but he definitely is a great director.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we've talked about it, and we talked about it at the start as well, pretty much covered it, but I think among people in the industry, they have a huge amount of respect for him. Spielberg's a massive fan. He said, Sidney Lumet was one of the greatest directors in the long history of film. Compelling stories and unforgettable performances were his strong suit. He's nowhere near the reputation he deserves of the likes of Scorsese, Hitchcock, Kubrick, Spielberg. He's just, he's not in that league, or he's not talked about within those names ever.
There is that documentary. Have you seen that? Is it called Lumet or Sidney Lumet?
It's called By Sidney Lumet.
Yeah, that's really, really good. Where it's with him.
Yes.
Like talking ahead of him talking about his films.
It's fantastic. So big recommendation, that one. That. Yeah, great. He wasn't favoured at the Academy Awards either. The only Oscar he won was in 2005 when he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yeah.
Spike Lee summarised this by saying, "His great work lives on forever, which is much more important than any Oscars you dig."
Classic Lee.
He's class.
But I think, like all of the films that we've mentioned there, anyone going back to explore any of his 44 films will be richly rewarded.
They absolutely will be.
So a wonderful homage to Lumet from us there. Until we get to the Rankin Lumet episode, that's all we'll have to see on The Great Man. We're not quite done. The final feature on Take 30 is to recommend something cool in the world of movies or entertainment that we've recently discovered, and that is coming up next.
Something new.
For our something new section, I'm going to hand over to Matt, who's got something great to tell us about. Isn't that right, Matt?
I do. It's something I'm very excited about, and it's a almost famous podcast in five parts.
Oh, wonderful.
Exactly. So if you are like me, and I think everyone on here, an almost famous fan, and if you're not, why not?
why not?
It starts on July 8th on Cadence 13, it's called, and it's hosted by a guy called James Andrew Miller, and he's been doing a series of these where he's looked at the origins of various things. So he's done one on Saturday Night Live, he's done one on Sex and the City, and so his next one is called Origins Almost Famous Turns 20. Get ready for the cast list, because it is immense. So on this, he's got Cameron Crowe, Kate Hudson, Billy Crudup, Frances McDormand, Patrick Fugit, Jimmy Fallon, Zooey Deschanel, Jason Lee, Peter Frampton, who was technical consultant in the film. Frampton's in there.
Lovely.
Nancy Wilson, who co-wrote all the Stillwater songs for the film. She's involved. And Penny Trumbull, who was the real-life inspiration for Penny Lane.
Oh, great.
Hudson's character. Nice. She's in there as well. So it's pretty much everyone he could get, I think he has got.
Fantastic.
It's amazing. So excited for it. Cameron Crowe says, "It's a little bit of a magic trick. He put the band back together."
Lovely.
Cameron Crowe's excited by it. And as I say, the guy is called James Andrew Miller. He's the host, and he says, "Almost Famous is on the Mount Rushmore of movies to share with his daughter."
Obviously.
Was that his quote, or was that your quote?
I like that phrase. It sounds oddly familiar. But, you know, I like it. I think I'll go with it.
He's been listening to you on this podcast.
Influencing people straight away, Matt.
Glad to hear it. So, yeah, that starts July 8th. As I say, it's called Origins, Almost Famous Turns 20. And you can find that on shows.cadence13.com/podcast/origins-with-james-andrew-miller, or it will also be on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Stitcher.
Okay,
so, great.
I think that sounds great.
Yeah, it sounds really good. It's all happening.
It is. It's all happening. That's a big heartfelt plug that you've given to a fellow podcaster, Matt. Let's just hope that they return the favour.
It would be lovely to think so, wouldn't it? You know, especially when he's ripping off my catchphrase. Sure as a love.
Well, that's it for the second episode of Take 30. A wonderful way to end the episode there, Matt. Well done.
Yes, it was. If I do say so myself.
Yeah, as ever. Consummate professional.
Yep, that's me.
We will be back on Take 30 in 2 weeks when we're talking about Tom Hanks and Big. In the meantime, Matt, Westy and myself will be back on ATRM Classic next week for our Halloween special. We're talking about the spooktacular Poltergeist, and that's the one that you're looking forward to, right, Matt?
Yes.
Are you not?
I'm looking forward to some bits of it, some people's reactions to some parts of the film. Right. I think it's going to be an interesting one. I think it's going to be a funny one to talk about, but there's loads to get into.
There is, yes. There's a lot to get into, yeah. If you could spread the ATRM word and tell the movie lovers you know about our podcast and the amazing benefits of becoming an ATRM Patreon supporter, we'd love that, wouldn't we, Matt?
Oh, totally. That would be amazing, guys. We'd love you forever.
Yeah. Well, I mean, don't make promises you can't keep.
No, not going to write checks me, body can't cash.
And things are also hotting up for us on social media, so to check out our world-class daily content, we are at @ATRightMovies on Twitter. We are at @all_the_right_movies on Insta. Search All The Right Movies on Facebook for our ever-growing movie community. We've just started a TikTok account, if you can believe that.
Dance moves all over the place.
How the fuck has that happened?
I didn't even know we were doing that.
Search All The Right Movies on there and sign up and like things or whatever you do on
there. I don't understand
like,
this. So, you
follow.
Know. Yeah, tell me what to do.
I'll Google it.
Right.
We've got a nice collection of videos on our YouTube channel with a lot more to come in the future. Some big plans. Mm-hmm. So subscribe and like our vids, please, because they are tip top.
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm.
Get in there first.
Yeah, get it on the ground level.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, our website is alltherightmovies.com. So until the next time, everybody, thanks very much for listening. See you soon.
See you soon, guys. Thank you.